Well, suffice it to say, I was not planning on recording a podcast here at 12:38 a.m. on a Saturday night, but I had to. This is maybe the greatest regular season game that I can ever remember. What do you think, Danny?
Yeah, you're right. Suns beating the Grizzlies was pretty exciting.
You know what? I considered starting with one of those like, oh, well, we had to record because Andre Miller is committed to signing with the San Antonio, you know, one of those jokes. And then I thought better of it. I didn't want to deprecate the moment, but, you know, I'm glad we could count on you to do that.
That's my job, man.
Instead. All right, so let's start off with this. Was that Steph shot the best game-winning shot you can ever remember from a regular season game?
I think so, and there are a couple reasons. Degree of difficulty in terms of the distance, like it wasn't fluky. You know, like there, I was remembering one. I think it was the year the Nets like basically weren't winning any games.
Yeah, it was the Devin Harris one,
yes.
Right? And then Rasheed Wallace had one like that too. That was from like the backcourt. But those are just lucky shots from guys who, you know, don't just casually pull up from 38 feet and drain game-winning shots like that's what they're intending to do. I mean, like, this is a real shot, you know, especially when you just consider the context, how great a game it was, how ridiculous the ending was, the comebacks that they had in both regulation and overtime, the fact that he's coming off a sprained ankle, it just, all of that context, and just what the Warriors are doing, what he's already been doing, like what this like crowning jewel now in the season for him, just ridiculous.
Do you agree with me that if his season ended tonight, that he would still be the deserving MVP?
The deserving, yeah. I actually, well, because it's funny, right? Like, so I'll tell you the story of how my night happened. I went out to dinner with my girlfriend and a couple of friends, and we recorded the game. She's actually kind of become a big Warriors fan now. In the last year after being introduced to Steph Curry, who thankfully is married, otherwise my relationship might not last very long. But anyway, yeah, so I just fastidiously avoided any kind of mention of anything and then came back and watched the whole game on tape, but, you know, without knowing what happened. And it was just like an incredible experience to watch it. And all I knew was that it was a good game. Like, I saw like one tweet that indicated like, are you guys doing an emergency pod? So I had some idea that something special was going to happen. But even knowing that, this was like beyond everything. And so when he injured his ankle, it looked so bad that I thought, wow, he might miss like a month, you know, like this could be a weeks long injury. And yeah, I think he still should be the MVP anyway. I said that at the time. I assume your thought process was somewhat similar.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and I got to watch the game live, so that was also a fun experience. But it was one of those games that I feel like it just kind of stands on its own. And I when you were talking about, you know, the great regular season games, for a brief minute, I couldn't even think of any other great regular season games. It was just this one. But that's the way it happens sometimes. And it was truly special in a lot of different ways. And these two teams have a penchant for fantastic games, especially when they're close to full strength, and this was, of course, no exception.
Well, so let's start off with Steph. Here's how I kind of want to run through this. So talk about Steph, then just kind of our general impressions of the game, and then for those of you who are really huge nerds, I broke down every possession basically in the last 10 minutes of the game, last 5 minutes, and then the overtime. But if that's too much detail for some of you, y'all can just turn it off at that point at the end. So I rewatched all of Steph's threes, all but three of them were basically shots that other players in the NBA could not credibly take and expect to hit on a regular basis. So the first one, he was going to his right off the dribble, ISO on Durant, quick release without his feet set, drains it. The next one, you know, he had a couple where he came off screens that were tough shots, but maybe, you know, so like Damian Lillard could make that shot or something. Then he's 4 feet behind the line on the wing against Steven Adams, a 7-footer, just sort of fakes hard without moving his feet and then just drains it. Maybe he had like 2-3 inches of clearance over Steven Adams' hand. Like, that was just a ridiculous shot. Like, what, just to sort of, like, I've never even seen anyone else attempt that shot before in the NBA, much less make it.
Yeah, I mean, that was the kind of analog for me, was the one that he made over Anthony Davis in the playoffs. I think it was in game 3. And you're just sitting there going, nobody else would even consider it. He doesn't even consider it. He's thinking about it the whole time.
Yeah, then there's another one that was just 4 feet behind the line off the pick and roll. Like, Cantor didn't switch out. I don't know. I mean, still not a shot that anyone else is really going to be taking. Then he had this incredible quick release on the right wing when Waiters tried to switch onto him. He crossed the crap out of Kyle Singler twice and hit a shot off the dribble. I mean, like, there's that. to do like that violent of like two violent crossovers like that and step back from the 3-point line, like nobody else in the league has that in their game. Then there was a 28 footer over Steven Adams contest, you know, another 7-footer. He was right there. Then maybe my favorite one was he was sort of, they were down by five. He kind of like was at the top of the key, but you know, his usual 5 feet back. He kind of like leaned forward and there was a screen that was coming and he just shot it really as the screen got there without his feet set. His right foot was like way behind his left. It's not a position that you ever see someone shoot from. It's a position that you basically see someone in when they're about to start dribbling to the basket, you know, drained it. Then there was the, lefty behind the back that goes 4 feet to his right, and then he made another shot over Singler, and then of course that ridiculous game winner from 38.4 feet away.
So you tasked me with finding some ridiculous Stephen Curry stats from this game, and that was not hard. So a couple of my favorites, and then we'll talk about some of them. So he took 24 shots in this game. 17 of those were pull-ups. And he shot, you know, 8 of 17 on those, which is good, very good. But he shot 8 of 12 on pull-up threes.
Yeah, that's insane to even get 12 pull-up threes. You know, I mean, I would love to know how many other players have even shot 12 pull-up threes in a game this year. Like, that's completely insane. I mean, for, you know, we haven't necessarily talked about this on the show, but for any normal mortal human, it is much, much harder to shoot off the dribble, A, because, you know, you haven't gotten a screen generally, or if you have, you know, there's another person guarding the screener who's coming up on you. And B, just because, you know, you don't have the ball in your hands. You've got to kind of wait for it to get into your hands off the dribble and then shoot it. But he shoots almost as well on those pull-ups. And I bet it probably is almost exactly the same once you adjust for, like, how close the defender is on those shots.
And that's why people like me push the greatest shooter ever argument earlier, is because the shots he's taking, even beyond the whole distance part of this, are substantially harder than a lot of the other players in that conversation.
Yeah, so what else you got?
Okay, so he attempted 16 threes. 12 of those 16 attempts were unassisted.
Yeah, yeah, or not potent, just, you know, wouldn't have counted as an assist if they
correct.
Got in.
Yeah, basically. it was 75% of the makes and 75% of the misses, actually. It was a weird coincidence. I asked our friend Seth Partnow, because I was just interested in this, the total distance of his makes, and it was 303 feet, which was the fourth game of anybody in the NBA having over 300 feet of makes, all four Stephen Curry. Do you want to guess what which game was the longest?
Oh gosh, no, I don't know.
Orlando on Thursday.
Ah, yes, of course it would be.
I mean, like, somebody, I think Adam Jacoby said, is like, that's a football field. It's a football field of makes in one game. It's unbelievable. In a game when he got hurt and missed some time and was hurt.
Yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing is, like, even when he came back, he was definitely limping around. Like, he was not right. It looked like it kind of warmed up for him a little bit as the game went on. The other thing to remember, too, is OKC was making him defend on every possession. They were putting him in pick and roll as the pick and roll defender on every single possession as well. I mean, like, the guy, the type of shape that he is in is unbelievable. Like, I mean, Russ is in pretty good shape, too, but, you know, he doesn't do the type of off-ball movement necessarily that Curry does. I mean, that's just another underrated aspect of how good he is the type of shape he's in. And also, of course, we forgot to mention, oh, by the way, he's tied the NBA record for most threes in a game with that ridiculous last three. And he now has beaten his own record by two with how many games to go now?
Well, he's
29 games still left? No, sorry.
It's 25, I believe. And this was his 56th game. It was the team's 58th.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. He missed two games. It's unbelievable.
So his averages, because now the Warriors' February is done. They don't play again until March 1st. Stephen Curry's averages for the month of February: 35.7 points on 54.5% shooting from the field, 7.4 assists, 5.9 rebounds, 3.7 turnovers. And then this is just, I don't even know how to put this. He is averaging 16.1 made threes on 12.1 attempts, meaning that he was shooting 6.1 over 12.1, which is 50.5% from three.
Yeah, that is
in a
just,
month.
It's absolutely batshit insane. Other than Curry, I mean, what else can we take away from this game here?
Draymond Green, so Steve Kerr said after the game that Draymond Green had the best game he could remember. He said maybe some Rodman games of a guy who didn't make a field goal. And from what I could tell, that's kind of a hard thing to look up, strangely enough. It seems like that's right. The other game I found, which was really intriguing, was Andre Miller almost had a no field goal triple-double in 2005 against the Nets, but that was in a loss. But it's just like, it's amazing to do that. And of course, box score stats underrate Draymond because his defensive impact is oftentimes not quantifiable in that way.
Oh, wait, I did have one more point. I'm Curry. I'm sorry.
Poor Draymond.
We now return to the Steph Curry Show. So I may have referenced this before on the podcast. I can't remember whether I did or not, but one of the first articles I ever wrote for when I started at Hoops World, other than my own blog, was how Steph Curry actually, despite the fact that he had blown up in the 2013 playoffs, really wasn't that great of a clutch player, and his clutch performance to that time really had not been very good. And my argument was that basically Steph would capitalize on mental mistakes. You know, he's a unique player. He could get open. You just kind of forget that you have to guard him. It's not in your DNA. But then when teams really lock in, or they start switching, like you remember even like Boris Diaw had great success switching onto him in that San Antonio series that spring of 2013 where the Warriors gave him a great series and then Steph sprained his ankle and so did Bogut and they weren't competitive anymore. By the way, Mark Jackson started Andras Biedrins and Festus Ezeli in one of the games in that series.
And I believe I basically asked him why after that game and he didn't give me a good answer.
Big shock. And basically, from that very point on, I think he had like his first game winner that I could remember when he hit a shot over Sean Marion at home. And since then, he's just been an awesome clutch player, as he finally proved again today. So it was, and just the reason for that is he's just totally advanced his skill level. He used to not be able to get a shot in ISO. Now he can get a shot in ISO against anyone, against Kevin Durant, against, you know, any big who switches onto him,
Kawhi.
Basically. You know, yeah, Kawhi Leonard. You know, it's just, it's insane. Like, he went from a guy who was a shooter, you know, had some okay, nice-looking dribble moves, but not the greatest handle. I mean, if you remember back even in, like, you know, when he was on the World Cup team in 2010, like, his handle was pretty weak. Like, that's why he barely played on that team. And now he has maybe the best handle in the league. And certainly when you combine that with his shooting, the best handle, the amount of work that he's done for his finishing, improving his quickness as well, his strength. I mean, because, you know, guys get up on him and then he just blows by him and gets to the basket and gets fouled, you know, or finishes with some crazy layup. It's just the skill development there we're talking about 2.5 years, essentially, is crazy. And that's from like age 25 to 27 and a half, essentially.
And I like that you brought up that Spurs series because he has talked in the past about how he thought that series and the Clippers loss were very important to his development because those teams were able to do things that took him kind of out of his game, out of the effectiveness in the offense. And so he basically said, I'm not going to let that happen anymore. Changed his game around to the point where you can't do those things. And also the team around him got a lot better. You know, Draymond had deserved so much more trust now. He's done a lot of really good things out there. So the ways I feel like you, partially because I've covered the team the whole time, you can see the evolution of it in some ways through their losses.
How freaked out were you at the Steph ankle injury?
Pretty, I mean, freaked out in the sense that it didn't look good, but not in the sense of, like, you know, the scope of this season. Like, I knew he would be back by the end of the regular season. It didn't look broken or anything like that to me. It just looked like, it looked bad, but it didn't look that bad.
I mean, when Russ landed on it, I thought, like, yeah, this could be pretty bad. I mean, when he wasn't, like, down, when he was able to put pressure on it walking off, I realized it probably wasn't that bad. But, you know, it certainly looked really ugly. I definitely thought it was going to be an injury that was going to keep him out for weeks. Then I couldn't believe that he came back in.
And I wrote when he came back in, I'm like, they better have a quick hook on him because it's not worth it for this game. And I was thinking too. That, but, you know, but it worked out.
Yeah. I saw that and I was like, all right, well, 73 wins, say goodbye to that. You know, just hope he makes it back for the playoffs. You know, it's really too bad. Such a shame to see this whole season derailed. And he was back. I actually still predict that he might miss a game or two now, just because he was able to come back in, and then I think it's probably going to swell up on him these next couple of games. I mean, they play again on Tuesday against the Hawks, and then they play OKC again on Thursday. I mean, how hyped is that game going to be? I mean, I think the biggest takeaway other than Steph's ridiculous heroics was that OKC, again, played a really, really nice game against the Warriors.
They defended well overall. I thought they did a nice job.
Yeah.
And
they took the Warriors out of what they want to do by a ton. I mean, if they weren't for Steph's heroics, the Warriors would have been awful on offense in this game.
Yeah, there were a couple moments. There was another game on this road trip where that happened, but it was only early on. Oh, that was, I think, the Orlando game where he had 6 makes in the first quarter and everybody else had 2. But the Thunder deserve a lot of credit for that, and they're a team that I feel like you can iron out some holes in the rotation, and obviously when you give their best players a higher share of everything, they're going to be so much more dangerous because, as Seth and a few other people pointed out, their starting five defends really well. It's just kind of everything outside of that things get shaky.
Yeah, I guess Draymond Green did have 14 assists. He had 14 of the Warriors' 25 assists. But they only had 25 assists on 45 shots, which
is an overtime game.
Yeah, or I'm sorry, 45 makes. Yeah. So that's not horrible, but I mean they weren't moving the ball the way that they normally do. I would wager that their number of passes was way lower than it usually is. And Oklahoma City's defensive strategy, which worked in the second half in that game earlier in the month in Oakland, worked really well. Again, they had KD guarding Draymond Green. Then they would switch. They didn't really try to go to Draymond in the post against Westbrook at all. They had a little success against that in Oakland. I wouldn't mind seeing them try that a little bit again. But still, you know, if that's what you're doing, that's got to be a win for Oklahoma City. And so, yeah, I think that really Barnes was completely powerless to do anything against Ibaka. You know, I mean, I can't even remember how many times Barnes even got a touch in this game unless he was, like, wide open under the basket. And the fact that Barnes didn't really get very many threes when Ibaka is also doing a great job protecting the basket, and the Warriors had a million missed layups in this game, and Ibaka was a big part of that. I think that's a big win. And Barnes, if they're going to handle Oklahoma City the way you would hope that they would, Barnes is going to have to play a lot better against Ibaka.
And for me, the big reason why at present, and of course this can and probably will change over time, that I think Oklahoma City is a tougher matchup for the Warriors is that I feel like Oklahoma City can get to their offense more reliably than the Spurs can against the Warriors, because the Thunder have that, you know, they have Durant, who is the toughest guy for this team specifically to guard in the league that isn't on their own team. And I think that's a big factor. Russ can, of course, get his. And if you, you know, change the way you use Robertson a little bit, I think that you can make that even stronger than it was in this game.
Yeah. So let me see a couple of other notes I had on this one. Russ's line in this game was not good. 10 out of 29, 0 of 6 on threes. He had 13 assists, true, but he also had 7 turnovers, which is ugly. Those turnovers really in general were what killed Oklahoma City. They had 22 of them on the game, and a lot of them really in the second quarter especially enabled the Warriors to kind of get back into things a little bit, whereas I thought Oklahoma City in general had a pretty good game. The Warriors had no answers for Durant, who was 7 of 11 from 3 on his own, many of those pretty contested shots as well. I think too, and if Durant doesn't foul out, they probably win that game.
I would think so.
As well. Although I thought it was a good call that he fouled out on.
And the one before was good too.
Yeah. They also had 16 offensive rebounds, so only 4 for the Warriors. The Warriors really miss Festus Ezeli. The Warriors backup bigs, Varejao, continues to be terrible. I mean, I actually would probably rather just have Spates in there, frankly, because at least, you know, Varejao is a huge record scratch guy already on offense. He really, every time he gets it, he's just either doesn't take the mid-range jumper or, you know, it kind of takes him a while to get it off, and it's not really a great shot for him anyway. He'll miss layups. You know, he had, like, they tried to throw him an alley-oop against Orlando that he just caught with the very tips of his fingers and then kind of tried to throw up a layup that missed. I mean, he really is just, maybe he'll get into it a little bit more as he learns the system, but I really thought that he is not a good player anymore, and I've seen little to dispel that notion in his first 3 games.
Cameron Payne didn't play. I think that long-term, I think he's a notable factor in terms of if these teams face each other in a 7-game series, which I still hope happens. I think he can be a nice, you know, he's not a perfect fit, but if he's playing 10 minutes a game, I think that's a nice little change of pace for them.
Well, I do think having him out there against Steph, he's probably going to screw up. You know, maybe you can use him against Barbosa, although Barbosa has this habit of kind of cooking younger players. Like every young player that he goes up against, he'll just blow by him to his left or get him with like a quick cut or something like that. Like he's really smart for those guys. What Donovan said was that basically they are trying Foy out in that position as essentially the backup point guard. But one thing that acquiring Foy has done, and they moved on from DJ Augustine, is that now they are fully staggering KD and Russ at all times. One of them is in the game when it's competitive. I think that's a much better way to go. And so they just have KD be the guy initiating the offense, handling the ball, and then they have Foy kind of playing off the ball. He didn't do anything in this game. So you don't if you've got KD in there, you don't necessarily need another point guard. So, you know, Donovan said he wants to see how Foy looks in that position. We'll see if that means that Payne's going to get another look or not. I don't really lament that much that he's not going to play. I mean, a rookie like that against a team like Golden State, I don't really think he's going to like make some big difference for them.
I think he can create offense, and as we saw in the overtime, they have trouble doing that when Kevin Durant's not on the floor.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's certainly true. But then Russ will be on the floor, so you don't necessarily need... I mean, the nice thing about Payne is at least, you know, Russ could defend a shooting guard, and then Payne can at least shoot. You know, he's somewhat of a threat, you know, and that's... We'll get into it, too, when we go through all the possessions. I will explain to you exactly how their lack of two-way wing threats killed them down the stretch of this game.
Do you want to talk about the death lineup?
Yeah, we certainly should.
So in the aggregate of the game, so they played 10 minutes together, the death lineup was plus 62.8, which is
per 100 possessions,
which is pretty good. They're plus 49 per 100 possessions on the season now after tonight's game.
Yeah, I thought they were really, you know, and this is another crazy comeback for that lineup, too. You know, if you're down 10 with 5 minutes left or down 11 with 4:37 left, as they were here, they're in a very similar situation against the Clippers. You know, that's really 97-98% win expectancy for most teams at that point. If you're up by that much with 5 minutes left, you know, I think it's deceiving to think that the game is kind of still up for grabs when it's a 10-point game with 5 minutes left. That just very, very rarely happens that the team will come back in that situation. And the Warriors have done that now twice this year. They came back from like 10 down to tie it, I think, with 3 minutes left in game two of the finals last year. Like the comeback ability of this team is unbelievable.
And that, I think, centers on the defense in many ways, too, because this team can reach a level on that end that creates a lot of easy offense for them and that teams just don't score.
Yeah, and as you noted, the Warriors are now have a 41 net rating and are 20-1 in games that are within 5 points with 5 minutes or less remaining. Oklahoma City is plus 2.8 and 19-13 in such games.
And Oklahoma City they've struggled a little bit against, you know, the best teams in the league, and the Warriors I think they're undefeated against teams in the top 10 in record right now.
All right, so let's get into the hardcore breakdown of the last 10 minutes. I just enjoyed rewatching every second. I was kind of just more watching as a fan. You know, I wasn't taking notes or anything when I watched it the first time through, and it was a pretty fun game to watch as a fan. So when the death lineup was in, Oklahoma City scored 7 points, 2 of 8 from the field with 2 turnovers, and Golden State had 18 points, 5 of 6 field goals with 1 turnover, and that last 4:37 of regulation. It was 96-85 after Russ's drive. And before that, they had Livingston in, and Steven Adams was guarding him, which actually works great. That is a great tactic because Livingston's not going to shoot outside of 15 feet, and his best offense is posting up, and he's not going to post up on a center either. I mean, probably what I would do with that is actually put the ball in Livingston's hands and have Steph or Clay set a pick and roll for him. And then he can either just drive into the basket unmolested or throw it to Steph or Clay if they switch it, and then they'd have Steven Adams on it. But that's neither here nor there. So right when the death lineup comes in, Steven Adams switches on a baseline out of bounds onto Clay, which is a surprise that they would just be switching everything like that. And Clay actually cut and was able to sneak a layup in over Steven Adams. I'm not sure that Oklahoma City really quite knew what they were doing there to be switching that play with Adams onto Clay.
And while we've talked before about how much Steph Curry has improved his game, Clay's finishing has also gotten substantially better since when he started. And there was a running joke among the Warriors fans and media kind of at the time about clay-ups, which was basically him botching layups. And now he's one of the more successful guys of the team at it.
Yeah, another guy who's just improved his skill level immensely. So there are a couple of exchange of misses. Westbrook drives. He probably got fouled by Draymond. Ibaka missed on the baseline on the rebound. Russ got caught out of the play after he tipped it. And then Curry drove down with the ball. He had two guys on him, which were Durant and Ibaka. And Ibaka left to go and get Barnes at the three-point line. KD, I think, was expecting Ibaka to still be there, and Curry just blew right by him for a layup, and that now they're within seven.
Yeah, that was one of those plays, and I don't know why I always think KD will do a better job defending Curry, but he
does do a pretty good job. I think finally Curry got in his head by hitting some threes over him, just the threes he was hitting over everyone else, and then KD was kind of overcommitting to the three, and Curry was able to blow right by him.
That's a good point.
Because, I mean, KD, usually his strategy is, hey, I have a 7'4 wingspan, I'll back off and contest. But if Curry gets the shot off, like you have to get close enough to him that he can't get the shot off, because if he gets the shot off, it's going to go in more times than not.
Yeah, Steven Adams can tell him that.
So Van Gundy noted at this point that Oklahoma City was very slow getting into their offense. There was a foul by Andre on KD with like 3 seconds left on the shot clock after they basically took forever to start. And then there was 14 on the shot clock. They wasted time. And almost got a shot clock violation again when they tried to run a pick and roll and get Curry onto KD, but Green helped out, prevented the pass to KD, and then Russ had to just throw up a long three. As an aside, do you think that 14 is enough time on the shot clock after a foul?
I'm okay with it. I'd be fine with it going to 18 as well, but 14, you should have enough time to be able to actually do something. Like, you can run an action in that amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe because you would think it should be 16, right? Like, a foul shouldn't put the offense at a disadvantage.
Yeah, 16 would be, I think 16 would be preferable,
yeah,
for me.
Because you get 8 seconds to get it across half court,
right,
theoretically. But I think a lot of times, the offense just will sort of be like, all right, a foul, everything is reset. And then you're like, oh, wait, 14 seconds isn't really that much. So that's what happened to Oklahoma City. They're still up 7, though, and then Curry just came right down after the shot clock violation. Nothing fancy, just drained a 28-footer over Steven Adams after a pick-and-roll, and they're within 4.
And I think this is the point when I really thought, oh, they're actually going to, you know, have a real chance of doing this, because those first couple of steps are really important, especially because if the Thunder had really made a good shot in that time, I think they would have had enough of a cushion to hold on.
Well, I thought they were pretty resilient, ultimately. There are plenty of times, first when the Warriors took the lead finally in the third quarter, then when, you know, it looked like the Warriors were getting back into it, and they, I mean, we're going through the whole thing, so you'll see. I mean, they really were pretty resilient. They just, like, eventually ended up blowing at it,
yeah,
ultimately.
But, oh, for sure.
You know, I mean, I still think this was more the Warriors winning it than the Thunder blowing though, like, in any game, there were mistakes.
I agree with that. All I was saying was I didn't think the Warriors had a great shot of winning this game until that moment when Curry made that shot over Adams and put it in a four-point game. That was just how my thought process was when I was watching it.
Yeah. So the next possession down for the Thunder, the first pass occurs with 12 seconds on the shot clock. It was one pass. KD tried to ISO on Andre. Really tough fadeaway that he missed with 7 on the shot clock. And then Green got fouled, hit 1 out of 2 free throws, setting a screen. So now they are within 3. And after that, Robertson, I think, came back in at this point.
On the foul, yeah, I believe that's right.
Yeah, and so that enabled the Warriors, for whatever reason, they had Curry on Russ before that. I guess they felt like they didn't want to put him on Waiters. I don't know why. They never throw it to Waiters. But Warriors were now playing with Thompson on Russ. Robertson had a huge record scratch off a KD pass, but then he got an offensive rebound, and Billy Donovan took a timeout, which I thought was a good timeout to kind of be like, all right, guys, we need to move faster here. That was the first of many record scratches, times where Robertson's man's helped off him to gum up the works. It really was pretty difficult.
And then the next possession was exactly the same thing. Robertson, he tried to screen for Durant, and then Curry, because he was guarding Robertson, was able to help out to kind of mitigate that situation.
Yeah, but then KD is just so good. You know, Andre is able to recover because Steph helped, and then KD just drove and got fouled and hit 2 free throws. So the Thunder are up 5 at this point now. And then Curry just hit yet another ridiculous three. That was the one I talked about where Klay came over to fake the pick and roll screen, and he pulled up from that incredibly awkward angle that nobody looks like they're going to shoot from. It was just, I mean, he kind of, because of the ankle, I think he had to just sort of like rope-a-dope a little bit more than he normally would on some of these shots, and that was just the ultimate rope-a-dope to just lull his man to sleep and then hit the three right in his eye from 28 feet. So they're within two now at this point.
Within two. Then they Robertson set another screen for Durant, and they didn't switch this one. And then, so they had the same matchups. Then they did Durant.
Yeah, I mean, basically the strategy, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
The strategy was whoever Steph was guarding, you're either going to involve him in pick and roll, or you're going to have that guy set a screen for Durant and either try to get the switch there or to just get Durant open. And it didn't really work all that. Like, they were able to get something, and Russ just made some great individual plays in the overtime especially, but they weren't really able to get anybody open from that. They were just still kind of relying on great individual plays. I thought the Warriors generally did a good job of defending those plays. And finally, Robertson started just rolling to the rim off of Russ's penetration, got a couple of buckets late in the overtime. But generally, you know, it's like if he's not being guarded at all, and you score, if you're not being guarded at all and you score 10 points, well, all of the points that you don't, or all of the possessions you don't score on, is you're reducing the efficiency for everyone else on your team.
And while, you know, there is certainly defensive value to guarding Klay, we've seen teams put their best defender on him at a series of different times, including the finals. I just, in these kinds of circumstances, especially when Steph's going off, I'm not sure that's enough defensive value to justify having somebody who you do not have to guard.
The problem is, though, there's nobody else who's even going to help on offense, and they're not going to throw the ball to that guy anyway, not that they necessarily should. I mean, I guess you're saying it should be Morrow, I guess, who didn't play a single minute in this game.
Or Payne.
Yeah, or maybe Payne. I mean, maybe that's another
just,
one.
Just to have a warm body.
Yeah, I mean, so KD still was able to make another great individual play, drew help. Russ then drove off of that help, and Ibaka hit a baseline J like way at the end of the clock, even though they took forever to get into that action. They were able to actually score that time. So now they're up four.
Yep. So, yeah, so it's 196, and there's about a minute left? Is that about right?
Yeah, I think so. So on this next play, this was the Steph travel, which I thought was a completely miserable call. They ran a 5-1 pick and roll. Russ actually did a great job of denying Steph. He had to get the ball back after that pick and roll. KD was on him, blew past KD again, and he went for a jump stop, and I didn't really see what the travel could possibly be. He gathered the ball as he was jumping. He jumped, he landed, and then he jumped again to shoot it. Like, I mean, that's a jump stop. What they were saying on the broadcast was, oh, he didn't land with his feet together at the same time. Number one, I thought he did. Number two, if that is the rule, and I'm not even sure that it is, it's a stupid rule. Why would it matter whether your feet land at precisely the same time? How can you even necessarily control that? Why are the refs going to be looking to like time it when your feet land? I mean, it's the same number of steps whether they land at the same time or whether they land at slightly milliseconds apart. It just seems like a really dumb rule if that is the rule, and I hated that call immensely.
I disagreed with it as well. Maybe a little bit less vociferously, but I still really did disagree with it. But that gave Oklahoma City the ball back, and he rushed through it to Durant, and he missed it. Was it an alley-oop, or was it just kind of a lob?
Yeah, it was an alley-oop. Like, they were running, like, a floppy set, and there was, like, 6 seconds left on the shot clock, and Russ was just up top, and rather than have KD pop out, Russ tried to catch him napping, and it kind of worked. I mean, they threw it to KD, and I think maybe KD should have just come down with it, but he was kind of, like, behind the backboard, you know, right along the side of the lane, and he just airballed it way, you know, I think he was worried about hitting the backboard, and so he just airballed it right into the middle, and then they came down in transition and got maybe one of the key shots of the game. They got a 2-for-1, and they also got a 3 from Klay in the corner. I thought it was just Steph could have pulled up for 3. Instead, he drove, and he found Klay in the corner, really, with the game that Steph was having, a pretty unselfish play. I can't think of any other superstars who could be that hot throughout the course of a game and the course of a season who would say, in that situation, we need a three. Oh, I think I'll just pass to Klay Thompson, who obviously a great shooter in his own right. But, you know, let's just put it this way. Like, Kobe Bryant's not passing the ball, you know?
And Klay in particular hadn't had that great a night shooting. He made some shots closer to the basket. But from what I recall, at that point in the game, he hadn't made many deep shots.
I think that was his first 3-pointer.
Yeah, and I think he made, like, one 20-footer or something like that beforehand. But it wasn't much. Like, he was just not having that great a night shooting. And so it was remarkable. But again, Klay Thompson is one of the best shooters in the world too, so it's a nice little perk.
Yeah, so it's 199 with 35 seconds. That was so key because they got the 2-for-1. And Oklahoma City calls a timeout. KD drove once. Robertson had 2 record scratches. They threw it to him on the wing. He threw it to the corner to a guy who was less open than him, who then threw it right back to him, and he was open again, and then he just gave the ball up. But they still managed to get something going. I mean, they left Robertson in the game so that he could play defense going the other way if they didn't use a timeout. And OKC still managed to move the ball around a little bit, and Durant hit an amazing 3 after Ibaka got closed out in the corner. Andre helped out on him just a little bit too much, and then KD drained that 3 over a pretty good contest, it looked like, by Andre. But, you know, KD is almost 7 foot, and he made that shot, and so it was 103-99. You thought the game was over at that point with 14.5 left.
Yeah, Amin Alhassan drew a nice parallel to that, where he said it was like when Rasheed Wallace Rasheed Wallace didn't close on Ori, because it was like you made the right basketball play, but just kind of wrong in that circumstance and just got burned for it. Like, you know, closing on Ibaka was probably the right basketball play, but Durant is, like, giving up a 3 in particular, considering it was a 1-point game, is just devastating. So, you know, it happens sometimes, and your instincts can take over, but, you know, they ended up working out. That didn't work out, but, you know, they were able to overcome that, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, so I thought that Kerr, other than the Varejao experiment and a few of the rotations, really down the end, did a great job of coaching. They, of course, didn't go for the quick 2. I mean, if you have this team, you definitely should not go for the quick 2 when you're down 4. So they tried to get Klay a 3. They overcommitted, and then Klay was able to drive and actually get, like, what the quick 2 is supposed to be, just a wide-open layup, completely uncontested. The problem is when you go for the quick 2 right away, and you get stopped, then you have no kind of second option. Like, if you go for the 3 first and they take that away, then you go for the 2, but you should at least have your first option in that situation be for a 3, and that's exactly what worked. And then the best part was the fact that they didn't foul immediately afterwards.
Yeah, that's kind of what you kind of have to do in that circumstance. Well, not have to do in that circumstance, but you're giving yourself a better out. And I think Oklahoma City was planning on that because they didn't put themselves in a situation where they really gave Durant somebody to pass it to after he got the ball.
Yeah, and I mean, NBA teams don't really practice press breakers, and they had a timeout left in which they could have advanced the ball. You know, I think there were 11 seconds left, essentially, at this point. I mean, the speed with which Golden State was able to score in some of these situations were critical. So, there's enough time left there that you're not under 8 seconds. Like, KD has to make a pass. They have to get it over half court or risk a turnover. I mean, I thought Oklahoma City did the right thing by inbounding to Durant. He's their best free throw shooter. You assume that they're going to foul him rather than taking the timeout and advancing the ball right away. If you have the chance to get it into him, you do that. But then the Warriors did a great job trapping him, not quite in the corner, but pretty close, and chesting up but not fouling with their hands. And that can always be very effective. You make a guy pick up his dribble, you can kind of, especially a skinny guy like KD, you can kind of use your chest to, like, knock him off balance, make him feel like he's kind of falling away, he has to give up the ball without actually getting called for the foul. That worked really well, and the press was fantastic. Steph was denying Russ right under the basket, and Klay Thompson, who was also right under the basket after making his layup, remember, he made the shot, you know, so he then sprinted all the way back to half court to intercept KD's long lob pass to Waiters. Ibaka was pretty wide open, but I think KD was kind of turning over the wrong shoulder to see Ibaka and also maybe just didn't want to throw it to a big man. And Klay made a great play to knock it away. Draymond Green made an unbelievable save back to Klay, and then he threw it ahead to Andre. KD, who had just turned it over, then fouls Andre, and I thought that was a pretty good call. I mean, he pretty much landed right underneath him. I mean, that's the Bruce Bowen call. That's what they've been emphasizing pretty much. What chance did you think that Andre had of making those free throws?
Oh, God. below 50% of making both. I thought he was going to miss him. Yeah. And also, we should mention on that play, the guy that stuck out to me was Roberson. I just kind of, it seemed like he lost himself a little bit in it, because he was the guy who, for Oklahoma City, was kind of in the middle of the part of it that was actually the most perilous, which was Green tossing it back to Clay. Because there was ball.
Yeah, he kind of just stopped, like he expected it to just go out of bounds. And I always talk about this too, and nobody does this, is what you should do if you're the defensive player. When somebody on the other team is saving the ball, you don't watch him, you don't sort of, you find a man, right? Because if you get in front of someone that you don't have a chance to throw an intricate pass, you take away the options, and then they have no choice but to really just throw it right to you. But he didn't really, he sort of took him a second to react. I guess he just thought it was going to go out of bounds, and so he wasn't able to intercept the pass back to Clay. That's a good point.
So then I agree with you completely that the foul was the right call, and Iguodala goes to the line shooting the biggest free throws since the playoffs. You said in 2012. I think that's probably the right call.
Yeah, those. I mean, Bulls fans will remember that the Omer Asik game, basically, where C.J. Watson, the Bulls were up one, I think. C.J. Watson threw it ahead to Asik instead of just holding on to it, and then Asik got fouled, and he missed both free throws because he's a horrendous free throw shooter. And then Andre got fouled and made two free throws to win game six of that series. And, you know, the Bulls had been down 3-1. That was after Rose and Noah both had injured themselves, and so the Bulls ended up losing that series. But those are probably Andre's two clutches free throws since then. And I think actually for a bad free throw shooter, sometimes when they're not expecting you to make it, like in this situation where you have to make two, it can almost be easier than in a situation where, you know, your team is ahead and you're just expected to make them, and then you feel more pressure. And maybe, who knows, maybe Andre thought back to that point. I'll have to ask him that, actually. But maybe not. He'll probably tell me no. Maybe that's a dumb question. But so then they went into overtime.
So we're halfway through the recap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, and KD also, that was his fifth foul, which ended up being enormous.
Almost
in the
immediately.
Overtime as well. Yeah.
So, yeah, first play down, Russ got a three-point play. One of those kind of unnecessary, I feel like it's an unnecessary foul, like in some ways, like you either stop him from getting the shot or you don't foul him at all. And especially early in an overtime, even though you get four fouls before you get into the bonus, I feel like it just kind of, it set them off on the wrong track in that way.
Yeah, it was interesting because Oklahoma City had gone big for pretty much that entire game in Oakland. Then they finally went with Ibaka at the five and Durant at the four to match up with the Warriors' death lineup, and they ran that Clippers double high play with Durant and Ibaka setting the screen. And the way the Warriors were supposed to defend it, which actually is a great idea, is whoever was guarding Ibaka, in this case Green, he's the one to help on the roll. Even if they went to Durant's side, those guys are both so close together that you can help even if you're guarding the guy on the other side. Green did not do that. Andre stuck to Durant, which I think was what the plan was supposed to be, and then Russ just went right in, and Green was so late that he just, you know, kind of waved at his torso and ended up getting a foul. So they're down three already right away.
And then the Warriors come back down, and they got the switch, which I assumed was what they were looking for on the play, but then it didn't particularly work out.
Yeah, Green was on Waiters, and it was another kind of missed layup where I thought Waiters did a good job on him. He's a pretty hefty guy. I mean, that's one nice thing that the Thunder have is Russ, Waiters, Robertson, Durant. Like, if you get the switch on those guys, like, you're not posting them up. You know, that's one nice thing that they have in their favor. And Draymond missed the layup there, and then they came right back down and got an easy Ibaka dunk, basically, because Draymond was out of the play after the missed layup. So they're down five. And again, you know, it's still worth noting, when you're up by five with 4 minutes left, you're a pretty big favorite to win the game under normal circumstances. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's that big of a lead because, you know, it's a two possession game, but those two possessions statistically, you know, you're probably got like, you know, a 70% chance of winning the game or something if you're up five with that amount of time remaining, if you're playing a normal team at least.
So that said, it doesn't help when on the next possession down, your best player and probably the second best player on the planet gives up a blow by and then fouls the guy. So it's a six foul and he's out of the game.
Yeah. And this is another time where Curry was, you know, KD had some comments after the game that, oh, you can't touch him when he drives, and he was saying how it was bullshit. You know, you could read his lips on the broadcast. It was pretty clearly a foul, I thought.
Absolutely.
You know, it wasn't even one of those situations where Curry kind of, like, changed direction to, like, get into his path after he had blown by him. I mean, I think, you know, KG just went for the block and just, you know, bodied Curry and fouled him. You know, I thought it was a pretty clear call, frankly.
It was absolutely the right call.
Curry only made one out of two, so they're up by four at this point. Van Gundy also talked about how you should get an extra foul in overtime. I agree with the general concept. I would probably wait until double overtime to do it. I mean, because if you kind of think that you get six fouls for 48 minutes, that's one per 8 minutes. So you're not playing another 8 minutes until the double overtime comes in. But I think ultimately you should be getting more fouls as you get into these like crazy late games.
And I've been a believer for a long time that if you get that, you should be able to give up a technical to have the guy stay in.
Yeah, I don't like that as much. I think that, and my reason for saying that is just I think that fouls are important because of their deterrent effect throughout the game, that guys don't want to foul for that reason. I mean, we already have so many times where guys will just give fouls that's already a scourge on the game. And I think if you allow that, yeah, at the end of some games might be more interesting if stars don't foul out. But on the other hand, you'll probably have guys just fouling way more throughout the game. So I think that it would make overall the product a little worse. Neither of us can really prove that, but that's kind of how I think is that fouls are important because players are just afraid of fouling out, and just over the course of the game, you're not going to foul.
You're saying you wouldn't want to see Tariq Black at 20 fouls in an NBA game, because I know I would.
Well, I don't think they'd be accepting a technical foul to keep Tariq in the game.
Byron 2016-17, man. I'm already excited for
it. So Russ went a little insane after KDE fouled out. He had a couple of times where he tried to attack Draymond Green in help situations, and he threw it away one time, had a really tough shot that just kind of caromed off the backboard another time. And that was kind of a key sequence as well, because Singler now was in for Oklahoma City, and the plan immediately became set a screen with Singler's man, get Steph onto Singler, and then have Steph attack Singler.
And that's a lot of the reason why I would have had somebody other than Singler in the game, is because you're not getting the positive offensively and the defensive negative is already there.
Yeah, Singler has not been hitting any threes at all. He wasn't even really camping out at the three-point line providing spacing.
He had no assists on the season through like December.
Yeah, but the first time down after that first Russ turnover, he just lost Steph. I mean, this was really the only, I would say, easy three-pointer that Steph had in the entire game. So now they're within three, 108-107. Russ just basically fell asleep and lost him in transition. And then the next time he tried a crazy layup, Golden State should have taken the lead, and Andre missed yet another fast break layup. Robertson did a great job of bothering that. I mean, the Warriors, I would say, probably missed like six or seven fast break layups that you're just, when you're watching an NBA game, the assumption is you're going to make.
Yeah, I commented on it during the game, and you weren't around to see it. So yeah, it was a lingering thing. I'd ballpark it at six or seven as well, and it was guys who usually do a pretty good job of that. I think Draymond had a couple, Iguodala had a couple, I think Clay had at least one. I don't count. I think Vergeau had one, but I don't count that.
Yeah, because we don't expect him to make that. Right. So Donovan, I think, called another good timeout to just say, all right, chill out a little bit here, Russ. You know, let's get you the ball in a way that'll work. And so they ran a play that they ran a couple times down the stretch where, again, because Robertson was being guarded by Steph, they ran a cross screen for Russ to the left side of the floor to try to get a switch and get Steph on him. And that worked. But then Clay just helped right off of Robertson again, just went over to the strong side zone, which is basically you come all the way across the lane to the near side block and basically give the guy who's trying to isolate nowhere to go. It's the initial kind of Tom Thibodeau strategy that really was one of the big impetus for these new move the ball offenses that we've seen in the last 5 years. And so Russ lost it after that, you know, nowhere to go. And then Waiters, in one of his few touches, was kind of forced to shoot a terrible fadeaway that missed.
I can't believe you took away the line. I was gonna say, if you were wondering how Dion Waiters was gonna touch the ball in crunch time, you got your answer.
Yeah, someone just losing the ball and then
it's happening really to bounce to him.
Yeah, and so you can see here, just again, hey, everyone, we say, all right, you know, they've got these two great players, and will always lament that they don't have a two-way wing and that they don't move the ball. And I would just say even maybe necessarily that, you know, with guys like Roberson, Waiters, who's going to shoot every time he touches it, Singler, who's been awful, Ibaka is not a playmaker. Those are the guys who are on the floor. So you could criticize that they have Russ making every play. But on the other hand, who else is going to do it among those guys? You know, you don't have guys with the intelligent, the playmaking ability that the Warriors have where they can actually move the ball. And frankly, because Oklahoma City was switching everything and stuff was so hot, the Warriors didn't really move the ball that much down the stretch either. But this is how it matters, right? Like, Roberson doesn't get guarded. Singler couldn't stop Steph to save his life. They just ran every play at him to get him to switch on. If you had a guy who actually could do those things, and even when KD was in the game, they were able to take advantage of those two facets, they would just be so much better of a team, especially in crunch time when you really get locked in on players' strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, especially considering they had another all-star caliber guy at one time.
Yeah, then Green missed a pretty open layup. Ibaka scared him after a great pass from Steph being doubled on the pick and roll. And then the Thunder were able to get the first of a couple of plays where Russ was able to drive. And on this one, it was Steph on Russ, and then he threw it to Ibaka. Not enough help from Klay Thompson off Roberson, and Ibaka actually was able to make the layup on that play.
I thought Russ did a nice job there. And another example, we saw this, you know, it's something we've talked about before, is that it can be really devastating when you miss a layup. And a couple of Oklahoma City's few, like, really good looks in overtime came in those circumstances.
So Thunder were up three. Steph tied it at a buck 10 with that ridiculous behind-the-back crossover on Singler. I did not agree with having Singler guarding Draymond. That's the guy that they want to set the pick-and-roll with the most. You're basically ensuring that he's going to get switched on. With the way Singler was getting just toasted by Steph, I would have rather had basically anyone else on the roster being the one to have to switch. I mean, probably what I would have done would be to say, we're going to put Roberson on Draymond, and then we'll put Waiters, who actually did a pretty good job on Clay in Oakland, on him. But they really wanted Roberson on Clay. You know, I don't know that even really worked out that well. And then you can have Roberson, their best isolation defender, the guy who's going to switch on to Steph, and you still have Russ on Draymond in the post, and he's strong enough to do an okay job there. So that was the one thing that I really didn't like at all from Donovan. I don't think that in the aggregate he coached a bad game. But I thought that playing Singler a lot, I mean, Singler was so bad defensively, like, why not just play Morrow at that point and actually get some shooting on the floor? Because Singler doesn't provide anything on offense or defense, really, at this point, the way he's played this year.
I was flummoxed by that. And yeah, of course, Morrow and Payne both had DNPCDs, but they couldn't have done worse.
Yeah, I mean, at least those two guys can do something on offense. And Waiters hit a couple of long
and they get respect too. Early. Like, they're guys that you have to handle a little bit differently. Like, you're even, you know, we've talked about that before, where, you know, if you have Anthony Morrow, especially considering some of the guys on this team played with him, like, you're not going to leave him open.
I agree. So 2:30 left. I swear we're almost done, really. Then it was that Russ Roberson pick and roll again. And he got blocked by Draymond, but he got the offensive rebound and the putback. And then Curry came down with just a ridiculous 30-footer with Russ not all over him, but definitely contesting. You know, it was basically from like the A in the Chesapeake arena sign, and it just barely went in and out, just like another jumper right on the possession after that when he was guarded by Singler did. I mean, that he was so locked in that even his misses were just like, you know, incredibly close.
Yeah. And then, so with a 2-point lead, the Thunder got the ball back, did a pick and roll, Russ Singler, and they got the ball to Ibaka, and I thought he was going to miss the shot. I didn't think it was going to go in. It did go in. So then they're up 4 points with a little less than 2 minutes to go.
Yeah, it was again a really a situation where the Thunder would have a massive advantage, but they still had Singler on Draymond, and Steph had that two that went in and out, and then Draymond had a great rebound. They switched it, so he had the advantage down low against Russ, and Ibaka was kind of engaged with Barnes. Roberson had also crashed the boards, and he had to guard Barnes right under the rim, or they would have had a dunk. Draymond, how many power forwards throw that awesome pass after an offensive rebound from the left block all the way to the right wing Clay just drains a three, and now they're back within one again. Just so many clutch plays. This was another one of them.
Yeah, I mean, so then, okay, I'm just, from there, you go into, what, unpause.
I got you. These are my notes, it's all right. Russ and Roberson, again, ran another play. Russ just beat Clay, even though there wasn't a switch, and Russ probably had a good argument for a foul call, but Ibaka got the offensive rebound. They ran the same play, again, didn't get a switch, and then Russ got kind of a dubious call on Clay, a blocking foul. So, I mean, I thought those two kind of average out. You probably get one out of those two calls. And Russ, a very underrated clutch free throw shooter, actually, in his career, by my memory, his two free throws. So then they're up three again. And so then they move Singler on to Harrison Barnes. And so guess who then went to go set the screen on the pick and roll?
The infrequently used Harrison Barnes as a screener, but he didn't really set a screen.
Yeah, I mean, they started doing that, you know, when they tried to hide Zach Randolph on him in the playoffs last year. I think he's better at it. He's just at, overall, is going to have to play better in these games against Oklahoma City. But, you know, I still think also my approach maybe would be if I were, especially with Andre not being that great of a shooter, Barnes not maybe that great of a decision maker, not having a good game shooting the ball, hasn't really been involved very much so far. I think I would trap Steph in that situation. I wouldn't do it when it's Draymond, because he'll make a great play. But I'd like to make Andre or Harrison Barnes prove that they can be kind of that playmaker in the pick and roll instead of letting Steph beat me, which he did. He got the switch on to Singler and drove and hit two free throws because he got clocked in the head by Singler.
Yeah, he got another completely legitimate call.
Then it was another one of these Russ drives with the pick and roll with Roberson, and there was help, and Roberson made a nice cut, and he made a layup that kind of just luckily rimmed in. And this was really another critical time in the game. 118-115, Golden State down by three with 33.9 remaining, and then Kerr set up a great timeout to set up what was a absolutely crucial 2-for-1 when they advanced the ball.
So yeah, so they inbounded the ball again. Harrison Barnes was the screener, and so they had Ibaka was guarding Klay Thompson, and then our good friend Kyle Singler messed it up. Klay got open back door, and this was actually the second time this week. I think the other game was at Pacers Hornets, where a team was up three and committed an absolutely devastating foul to get an and one.
Yeah, but really, I mean, that was a bad foul by Russ. But they obviously were switching everything if Ibaka got on to Singler initially, because Draymond screened for him, and then Barnes screened for Clay. It was a good play by Kerr, but the Oklahoma City was obviously switching everything, and Singler, for whatever reason, didn't just switch on to Clay, even though he's a more natural matchup for Clay than Ibaka was, and so Clay just went backdoor, and then it was really a pretty miserable foul by Russ as well. I mean, the number one thing that you just don't do in that situation when a guy has a layup and you're up three is foul. I mean, especially when you're, you know, I mean, Russ plays 1,000 miles an hour, and he does things athletically that most point guards can't do. But if you're a point guard, you know, you're not a shot blocker. Just let it go at that point, I think.
So, and another huge part of how that worked was that not only did they get the tie despite not taking a three, but they still had enough of a differential with a timeout remaining that they could play defense and not have to, you know, not have to do anything weird.
Well then, all right, we only have two plays left now. But hey, I warned you guys that this would be thorough, I guess we will say.
It's like the playoff ones, man.
Yeah, I mean, this might even be more in-depth than the playoff ones. So they ran the same play, basically, we talked about before, where Russ got a cross screen from Roberson. The Warriors were ready for it this time. They did not switch. Clay was right on him. But then after that, the spacing by the Thunder was just absolutely pathetic. Roberson is just standing on the opposite block. His man, Steph, was able to just be right in the middle of the lane. Ibaka was standing just inside the free throw line in the lane. Singler is maybe like, you know, kind of like the opposite elbow, you know, maybe 18, 19 feet away. Not even at three. So, and then Waiters, of course, was in the opposite corner with his hands over his head asking for the ball, but he had, you know, there's no way he could throw the pass through, and there were six bodies in between there and Waiters. So where Russ was, there was not a single person at the three-point line spaced out where he could have thrown it to him, and he tried to just pump fake, get Clay in the air. Clay did a great job of staying down. Russ got it back, but then he kind of had to throw up a pretty difficult shot, and then Draymond Green was isolated under the basket, basically, because Barnes had to help on that rush drive that he missed. He had Robertson, who was actually one of the best rebounders in college, a great rebounder, and Ibaka both. Green was able to just tip it away to Andre, and then he found Steph on the left wing with Robertson in front of him, and Robertson's instincts took over, and when you're guarding Steph Curry, that can be a very bad thing.
And they had a timeout left, but they had the play, and so you're sitting there. I mean, I was thinking about it, and it's like, okay, Steph's going to take this shot, but what changed it was where he took it.
Yeah, I mean, because what Robertson did was he just kind of turned around for just a second and jogged back, and then he's kind of realized, oh wait, it's Steph. I better turn around. He decided to turn around. Yeah, maybe about 30 feet from the basket or so. But as he turned around, Steph was already gathering the ball to shoot it from 38.4 feet. And he got, you know, a pretty good look and you know, was still kind of leaning forward a little bit, but it was pretty much a normal shooting motion. And what did you think as that shot went up? Like, what was sort of your expectation in your head? Did you think he was going to make it?
Yes, I did.
And that's, you know, you saw there was a bunch of NBA players who tweeted that I read, and I think it was Kalena Azubuki said the same thing, who's a former Warrior, now an analyst for CSN Bay Area. He said the craziest thing wasn't that he made it, it's that you expected him to make it. And I had a tweet the other day when he made that 50-footer against Orlando. They were shooting free throws at the end of the third quarter with like 3 seconds left, and I was like, hey, get ready for the Steph 50-footer. It's going to happen. And then he made the shot. I mean, it's now, you know, he's made probably 5 of those on the season and like 3 in the last month. Like, you actually expect him to make that shot? It's just completely insane.
It reminded me of when I asked Caspi what his range was, and he said anything inside half court. I still haven't asked Curry what he said, but I think his answer, if he gave a real one, would be about that. And, I mean, we see him practice from the logo, from some part of the logo, every home game, and that isn't too far off that.
Yeah, and he makes 50% of those shots, you know, maybe even a little bit more than that sometimes. You know, it's totally crazy. And I thought the reaction was crazy. Like, I watched some of those in arena, like Instagram videos of it, and it seemed like there was like a lot of disbelief, obviously, but there's actually like a fair number of people cheering. I guess those were just Warriors fans in the arena, or, you know, just people just bowing to just how ridiculous his performance was that he made that shot. I mean, it's just one of those things where, like, you know, that's not a lucky shot for Steph Curry, and that is probably a lucky shot for anyone else in the league, maybe anyone else in NBA history.
Those reaction videos were great. My favorite, I actually haven't seen a clean one of the Warriors bench when the shot goes in. That's the one I've been looking for. But Oklahoma City's bench, when the shot is in the air, a couple of guys are just like, you can kind of see on their face that they think it's going in. And I can't even describe what that feeling would be like of a guy hitting a 38 footer on you and you see it going in before, you know, like 10 feet out, not just as it, you know, goes through the net. And, you know, Stephen Curry's the best player alive, and that's what happens.
So I think the best way to end this best regular season game that apparently either of us can remember, and feel free to tweet me with some other options that you think are better than this. I was hard-pressed to remember. I think I have a pretty good memory for this stuff. This is Steph's tweet from 2012, but it's been making the rounds today. He says, "For me, once you experience winning, it becomes an expectation, and you do everything in your power to avoid losing feeling. So I hate losing." I think that's a great way to end this very special Dunked On Basketball podcast. Till next time. Thank you.